Take a network break. Grab a baker's dozen of low-calorie, high-throughput virtual donuts and settle in for the Packet Pusher's weekly take on tech news. I'm Drew Conrey-Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team's skills up to date. Visit itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. To the news, a private equity company is making a bid to purchase Gigamon. They're a maker of network visibility appliances and software. Reuters is reporting that Evergreen, which is the private equity company, has made a formal bid, although the amount was not disclosed.
So Evergreen is a bit of Elliott management, right? So it's not just Evergreen, which you've never heard of before. It's actually part of Elliott management that's bought out a large swath of tech companies over the last 5 years. You read about that, didn't you?
I did, yes.
Yeah. Oh, see, that was why I asked. Gigamon, of course, is a company that makes what we generally call visibility fabrics. It allows you to put taps on the network and divert the traffic into something that allows to collect it. They've been expanding their product in new and different directions. Big Switch has been chasing them, of course, and forcing them into a transition, as has SDN more generally. They've been introducing new features into their product around interception and things like that. And I think a private equity company might see a security company, given all of the the recent security breaches and exfiltration of data and ransomware, as a market where they could really do something if they could flop them all together. Because remember, most of these security companies are all using the same machine learning algorithms to determine, you know, threat actors, bad actors, sources, you know, malware in the wild and that sort of stuff. And there's actually probably a business in my, you know, my ignorant, untrained, unknowledgeable mind saying, why does every one of these companies keep reinventing the wheel? Why isn't there just one machine learning algorithm that can agree that all of these are bad? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I was actually thinking, why is a private equity firm going after Gigamon? My thought was that, you know, this is essentially a small market for the number of folks that actually need the kind of visibility you can get out of Gigamon is bleedingly small. And so what is a private equity firm going to, you know, are they trying to squeeze blood out of a stone here? But that security play makes more sense and makes me think, yes, okay, maybe there's some value they think they could get out of this with a little bit of chopping and reorganizing.
Well, Elliott's got a whole bunch of security companies like Blue Coat and others, and they've all been out building up their own machine learning. And of course, building a machine learning division to recognize, you know, untrusted sources and stuff like that is expensive. So maybe you could build one big machine learning thing and merge all these companies together. I don't know.
So to a super security portfolio.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these products do actually do pretty much the same thing and all rely on the same signals. Like F5 had to build up a security division over the recent years and so forth. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's interesting in the sense that convergence is, I've been saying that Gigamon needs to converge for a long time. Standing out there as a visibility fabric didn't make a lot of sense. I'm not sure how long it can last alone. It needs to be part of something bigger. I don't think it's a product in its own right anymore. I think it's a fries with that product, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
So
yes.
Big Switch, for example, with their big...
Bigmon.
Bigmon is, you know, you can have fries with that. Can be a data center fabric or it could be a visibility fabric. And,
you know, it's a dessert topping. Course, it's a floor cleaner.
That's right. Cisco, of course, has put the visibility straight into its silicon in the Nexus 9000. So if you're willing to stump up for cloud scale ASIC Nexus 9000 switches, then maybe some tetration will give you what you want, right? You know, so that instead of the fabric being one thing and the monitoring software being something separate, there's a convergence going on here.
Yep.
And so I think it does make sense for Gigamon to look for exits before the door closes on the opportunity.
Well, apparently Evergreen already owns just over 15% of Gigamon, and Evergreen and /Elliott have gone to a couple of banks apparently and gotten financing, so maybe a deal is happening.
Yeah, this is another one of those times when you put a ring on it. Go and you have a date, you know, you put 10% in, get a good long look at the books over a long period of time, see what's happening, and then maybe you decide, okay, I want to put a ring on it. Maybe that's what's happening here.
Could be. Yeah, we'll update as we get more news. Moving on, we had talked last week about the massive data breach at Equifax. More news is coming in, including the fact that as many as 44 million Britons may have had their personal information stolen. So, hey, it's not just us in the United States.
Yeah, so, you know, Equifax, of course, is a really significant sort of piece of financial infrastructure that's in private hands. This is something that in decades gone by would have been owned as a government division, like, and the government department would have owned it and all the banks would have gone and said, is this person creditworthy? And the government would have said, yes, you know, here's the data about those people. But We live in an era of small government where people are saying, oh, no, these should be private enterprises. And, of course, private enterprises don't actually have a moral responsibility, only a financial responsibility. And it really, really looks like Equifax just said, security, there's no money in that. We'll just take the profits. So, you know, as one of the biggest three credit reporting companies, it was breached using a very basic Apache Struts vulnerability. And it was a vulnerability that was announced in March. So keep in mind that they were compromised in July, or they discovered the breach in July, and the event took place in May. So they had from March to May to patch their systems and didn't. They discovered the breach at the end of July and then repaired it. So it took them well over 5 months to fix it. What should be an everyday patch that everybody knew was a problem. They didn't. And then even then, the data extraction went on for weeks, not days, but weeks before they realized.
I mean, it seems like it went on for months if the breach was discovered in May and then they finally closed it in July.
Yeah, so, you know, mid-May and the breach was discovered at the end of July. So you've had like 8 weeks or 10 weeks to extract the data.
Yeah.
That is like, so if you haven't got that then doubles down for me, because you should have even the most basic of DLP, data loss prevention technologies, should detect SSNs going out. They're like, you should not see SSNs going out the front end of your website, except, do you know what I mean? You should be monitoring for that. Mm-hmm. And they didn't even have that, it would seem. So this really, really highlights a fundamental incompetency at every level, in my opinion. From where I'm standing, obviously don't have enough information. And I really think governments should be, you know, getting in here, because if we lose these credit reporting agencies, there's a whole part of the credit industry is actually gluing up. So what's happening now is people are putting credit freezes on all of their accounts. And apparently it's overwhelming these companies with credit freeze requests, and they can't service them all because they're not geared up to do that. But what it also means is that applying for credit for many people, and particularly banks who send out pre-approved credit, you know, credit cards and things like that, finding that
it gums up the works. Yeah.
It gums up the works. So this free flowing credit industry is suddenly saying, hang on, we've got a serious issue here. So I think there's going to be a cascading thing going on. Then just to add insult to injury, of course, the United Kingdom Government Information Commissioner's Office, we have a special office over here to monitor information, personal information and privacy, and they've demanded Equifax tell them how many UK citizens, and potentially up to 44 million UK citizens, have also been breached, but Equifax hasn't released anything on that yet. And then just to add insult to injury, how much worse could it get, Drew? How much worse could it get?
You won't believe how much worse it could get.
So just to make the,
go ahead. Well, one of the things I know is that Brian Krebs, he's a well-known security blogger. He got a security company that's working with Equifax reached out to him to let them know that apparently Equifax has a web portal for employees in Argentina, and the administrative password and login was, wait for it, admin, admin.
That's how the employees log in.
Right.
who can modify credit records.
Right. And have access to credit records. Yes.
See, now that's leet hacking right there. So there's more. How much worse could it get, Drew?
Tell me, Greg, how much worse could it get?
Executives have been selling shares in the company to the tunes of millions of dollars, right? In the period that'd be after the discovery, but before announcing this unplanned security event, shall we say, right?
Curious, very curious.
And then I heard over on the Risky Business podcast, they were saying that apparently somebody also put some pretty substantial options down. So bought a $150,000 put on the Equifax price down and walked off with $4 million.
They're hedging. The bastards are hedging.
So it's possible that the hackers, whoever did the exfiltration, did it, but maybe somebody else got wind of the leak and put down a shorter.
Now that is a really interesting idea. You hack a company not just to steal the data, but to also hedge. Wow. Goodness.
Double dip.
Wow. Yeah. Now we're really screwed.
So, you know, and so then it just gets worse from here. The CEO put out a YouTube video, which was, well, let's say unconvincing was the most flattering I can come up with it. He didn't look really unhappy at all.
You could see the dead in his eyes. He was just like, you couldn't see the gun, you know, off camera to his head, essentially saying, here's what you got to say. Just say it. We'll get through this and move on.
Yeah. Actually, we don't care about the customers because we're still selling your data. It's not like you're actually affecting our income at all, which is a sad fact. the people who pay for Equifax are the banks, not you as a person. So
that's right.
You're just the product, you're not the thing. And then finally, they set up a website, which when the website was set up, it was initially listed by many of the malware companies as an infected site because it had a pretty dodgy name, and the website itself was insecure, and it was a badly configured WordPress site. And then a lot of people are still reporting even today. So this is like, what, 10 days into it now, mm-hmm. I think. Apparently, the site itself is still randomly just returning incorrect data. So you can go and check it out, and it might say yes, but it might say yes regardless of what data you put in. It might say, it might just crash, it might just do anything. And so basically, the whole website they set up for customers to check it is basically bunk. It's broken.
So here's the thing. Let's set aside the fact that, you know, there are tons of best practices and operations for running, if not a secure site, then a site that can respond to a breach, you know, in a semi-timely manner. Put that aside. There is a playbook out there for when a breach happens, the things you need to do. And they have just blown this too. They can't get anything right.
No, seriously, it really is amateur hour. Like, as somebody who's worked on designing firewalls and exfiltration and data loss prevention at the network layer, there's a bunch of just simple technologies in here that should have flagged like a massive data exfiltration.
Sure.
And they didn't have them, right? Because they would know. They would have shut this down much. So, and then institutionally, what they're now finding is that Equifax has like 99 other business units around the world, and all of those are insecure as well. People mm-hmm. are out there having a field day popping those. So it's just, you know, it looks as if institutionally Equifax had a fairly cavalier attitude towards IC security. They had no strategy to respond, and it's really going to get quite grim because this data is incredibly sensitive. Because if banks stop being able to validate customers according to the data coming from companies like Equifax, then issuing credit comes to a halt.
It certainly slows down, and that slows down the whole economic engine that drives the United States, pretty much.
And you could actually see it impact the bottom line of GDP, and that starts to affect the global economy, like national economies in the U.S. in particular, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a really, really serious issue, and it's not unreasonable to expect that eventually the governments will intervene and do something here. Probably, you know, who knows how far it will go and how far it will get. Obviously, the current government in the U.S., the leadership there is not very interventionist.
It's very pro-business.
Very pro-business. So they might get away with it, but I think ultimately the banks might actually start taking action here themselves because they have to have a trusted source of credit worthiness or credit references, and that's not happening.
Yes, and that's a good point. My understanding is the Security and Exchange Commission is getting involved in here to take a look, and maybe they'll lean on them a little bit in terms of the stock trade that went on prior to the breach. But you're absolutely right that the credit card companies are also going to feel some pain on this, and they are the ones who are going to lean hard, presumably, on Equifax, and that could
mortgage companies.
Yeah, yes, yeah, all of the lending systems out there that rely on consumer credit scores have a dog in this fight. Yes. Yeah. So,
how many people's houses are now struggling to get finance approved because this is
I also am wondering what the boardrooms over at TransUnion and Experian are like right now. Those are the other two big credit monitoring agencies. It must be a little
grim. There's a big I found this, what they call it, a mega thread over at Reddit, and mm-hmm. they've had like, it's really, really huge, and it talks all about the different things and how to go and report and what the things you should do, and there's a whole bunch. So if you're more interested in doing stuff at a personal level, follow up the show notes and talk about that. I don't want to overdo this, but except, you know, and talk about it as a personal thing. This is a technology podcast. But what I want to say is, you know, this is a company that's clearly abandoned its IT security responsibility. And I have the sense that it's not going to come out of this unscathed like others. I do actually think this is probably so large and so damaging to the larger ecosystem that this company may actually go under. It'll probably, customers are going to go after it. There's like a $100 billion class action started. There's a website in the US which is saying this is how you make a $15,000 worth of free money by lodging a claim against Equifax. It's literally, you know, they're the guy who set up the website to do automated parking tickets, challenging parking tickets. He set up one for Equifax. And all you have to do is, you know, go there, fill out the forms, lodge them yourself, and then turn up in court. But you'd fundamentally would get $15,000 out of that.
I might go look at that.
It might be worth a go. It sounds like just a little bit of work. But he's got all the forms and all the things and advises you on all the 50-odd states of America on how to do it in each state. So anyway, you know, if you really feel that, you know, if enough people get on the end of that and say, hey, free money, just for a little bit of, for a few hours work, that might be worth doing. That could really take them down. So, but, you know, IT security, you know, my, and the point is that I've always said IT security is a joke. Nobody takes it seriously. Even if it happens, there's never any negative consequences. If they can get away with this, then I'm right. If they don't get away with this, then I'm wrong.
Let's hope you're wrong in this case. That would be wonderful. And it may be in this case, I'll tell you what, we'll put that in the spreadsheet. Sure. All right. We'll see what happens. Yeah. All right. We got to leave that behind. Move on. VMware, they have announced a new initiative called HCX. It aims to allow companies to migrate applications from VMware environments on premises into a public cloud without making changes to the application. Sounds a lot like what they did with AWS, but this is a slightly different story.
Yeah, so AWS is actually a software-defined data center. So the VMware on AWS is an entire software-defined data center. You get vRealize and NSX and vSAN, and it's inside of ASX, okay?
AWS.
So that's not pit for pin. Unless you've actually got the full VMware software-defined data center, then you're going to have to basically upgrade or get to know all of these extra tools, how to run a vSAN, how to run it. And you may be in a different situation, whereas VMware HCX is kind of like I can't believe it's not but a version of the VMware that most of you are running today. Right? That's how I define it. You know, it's literally a version of ESX that runs in other people's cloud. So when you hit your vSphere client and start talking to it, there's a version of that in the IBM and OVH clouds. Now, the unique thing about IBM and OVH is that those are both vCloud Air network data center providers, right? So do you remember the vCloud Air network?
vCloud Air was essentially VMware's attempt to build out an infrastructure as a service offering, right? But on VMware technology.
Yeah, and we'll never know if it was because they couldn't make it work, which is what I suspect. You know, companies that use big companies like that that use their own software suddenly discover how bad their software is.
Ouch.
Or is it just because it took a lot of money to invest in buying hardware and buying data centers and power and, right, you know, it's just not your core business? I suspect it's a bit of both, you know, let me be fair. But in the end, they sold that business, the vCloud Air business, to OVH, who already has a big data center operation. And there's a whole bunch of partners in the vCloud Air network who provide ESX hypervisors, hosted ES type services. So this is an ES. It's down at the vSphere/ESX layer. It's not about all the other stuff. And basically, what you're doing is you're dropping in, according to the notes that I saw, and I haven't got a full briefing on this, so I may, you know, you should do your own due diligence here, but you have to deploy a hybrid interconnect appliance, which is a gateway to the remote site with intelligent routing to avoid networking middle mile problems. Mm. A WAN optimization appliance, which improves performance by utilizing WAN optimization techniques. And then the network extension service appliance, which extends layer 2 networks to the remote sites. This enables moving VMs to the cloud without IP address and MAC address changes. This service does not require the presence of NSX for vSphere. So you can see there's some key differences here. I sort of have a vision that you deploy these three appliances and then you put a, you know, over there in the IBM soft layer or the OVH vCAN cloud, you can now vMotion your ESX hypervisors into there. And boom, where you go.
Okay, so this is sort of the the ultimate vMotion dream. And when you say extending layer 2 network to the cloud, I can just in the back of my mind hear Yvonne Pepelniak crying out in pain.
Yes, I would imagine so. I think customers are going to stub their toes on this and then cry very sadly because it's actually not as simple as just vMotioning something into the cloud, you know. So it's a very much like this, I can't believe it's not butter. I'm going to lose weight because it's not actually butter. It's just margarine. I didn't lose any weight.
It's like cloud training wheels maybe. Is that a fair description?
No, not even. It's almost the worst possible way of doing cloud that I could think of. You know, if you're just going to pick up your VMs and try and vMotion them into the cloud without thinking very deeply about the impact of performance. You know, if I was to move a VM from London to IBM SoftLayer Cloud in America, what would happen? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So I believe it to be the I can't believe it's not cloud version of cloud.
Okay.
So we'll see how that works out.
All right. Very good. Yeah, we'll keep an eye on this and see how it goes. There's a recent survey from 451 Research finding that a majority of respondents are having trouble recruiting data center workers. Either there's a low candidate pool, workers lack the skills that the hirers want, or the workers' salary demands are too high.
You know, we should have put this in the surfing dog section. really. You know, there are three main reasons for a shortage: is a lack of specialized and experienced candidates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not enough locally based applicants, and a tendency for candidates to want more money than we're willing to pay.
Right. Well, you have the skills, but we don't want to pay you for them.
Yeah, okay. And also, so the fact that you located a data center in the middle of nowhere because you got a free set of land and some government support.
And some low-cost electricity, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But now you just realize that actually nobody wants to live in the asshole of, you know, where there's not even a Starbucks sort of thing.
Right.
Well, gee, what a surprise, right?
Right, and you might have to pay a little more for the people who are willing to work there.
Yes, that's right. And so, you know, I just... Once again, why do companies continue to bitch and whine that they have to train workers? If you look back over history for the whole era, for the old industrialization era, companies had to train workers, whether it was to run the cotton gins in the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. or if you had to, you know, if you were a fitter and turner and you wanted somebody to be a carpenter or a plumber, you had apprenticeships and you had to do apprenticeships or you'd have nobody to work for you. So why is it that tech companies suddenly feel that they shouldn't, you know, whining and bitching that there's no skilled staff when you don't train them is kind of like, yeah, off you go.
It's very frustrating. Yeah. I mean, it's this whole notion, I think, that's affecting much of certainly the United States economy in that employers are looking to take less and less responsibility for their employees. They're just literally cogs. And if they aren't the right fit, they're very disposable because it helps keeps costs down and, you know, puts more money to the bottom line in the long run. And
sure. And if you do find people who've got skills, well, then you haven't had to pay to train them, so they're worth more. And it's not, you know, in an era of capitalism, if I've spent $5,000 or $10,000 plus a massive amount of personal effort, well, guess what? I don't want to work for free. I also don't want to work in the arse end of the world.
Right. If you've gone out on your own and gotten your own training, you expect some compensation for it.
Exactly, as you should, especially if you've done it on your own motivation and in your own time. And then, you know, if you want me to go and work in some, you know, the back of beyond, then I expect to get paid extra for that,
mm-hmm.
not less, right?
Right.
Because if you want high-skilled people to work where there's nothing useful, no life, then yeah, sure. Yeah. So just got my gander up, that one.
I did, yeah. No sympathy. No sympathy from this show.
Not a lot, no.
All right, moving on. This week, we saw a blizzard of announcements around carrier-delivered SD-WAN. Comcast, Tata, and China Telecom are just the latest carriers to declare their own offerings. And VeloCloud also had an announcement that they have 50 service providers on board with their products.
Yeah, so I didn't want to talk about each of these because individually they're tedious and boring. Who cares? You know, Comcast, Tata, China Telecom have all got, you know, picked up certain vendors or built their own. So Comcast built its own. Tata's gone in with a vendor partnership with its existing network. And they're all saying how they're SD-WAN. And I just, the thing about SD-WAN to me is that as a customer, the greatest ROI comes not from having better routers or, you know, better managed circuits. It actually comes from having multiple carriers and getting your carriers to fight amongst themselves to sell you a service and getting price competitive bandwidth.
So you're saying if you go with an SD-WAN service delivered by a carrier, you're potentially losing out on that competitive pricing you might get?
Yeah, almost certainly. And I actually wouldn't think that SD-WAN delivered by these vendors wouldn't be a good idea. So these companies are looking at their existing 5+5 WAN contracts and going, hell, we're losing all of those to people running them over the internet. Let's race out there and get an SD-WAN and lock them back into a 5+5 year contract on a managed SD-WAN. And I think the carriers are hoping to protect their revenue here so it doesn't just walk out the door.
Certainly.
They are attempting to add value here by adding virtual firewalls to their appliances, you know, doing some NFV and a bunch of stuff like that. But I think customers should be very careful to understand what SD-WAN means and how that there are many ways to do SD-WAN, just in the same ways there's many ways to run a routed network and to outsource a routed network. And be smart and think carefully about what you want to do. I still believe the best way to go is to go with a company that has appliances, that puts them on your site and lets you have, you know, multiple carriers in your network, of which the majority would be internet. And you can cut your costs by at least 50%, if not 75% in the WAN. And that's what you should be going after. Now, I do understand that that's not for everybody. So I'm not saying these things are stupid and crazy. They are there for some people, but I don't think it makes sense for most people. I should think, be very careful not to get stuck in here.
That's right. Don't just go running back into the arms of the carriers for no good reason. You have options. You should examine them. All right, we have to take a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, IT Pro TV. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. You can get the most current IT training with over 2,000 hours of content and more than 125 hours added weekly. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide via Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, your computer, or even on your smartphones using iOS or Android apps. They've got a whole calendar of upcoming courses, including Kali Linux, CCNA CyberOps, CompTIA A+, and more. And also, you can make sure your team is ready to fight off the latest cybersecurity threats with IT Pro TV's Team Solution. It provides group pricing and access to the IT Pro TV Supervisor Portal, which means you can check in and make sure they're actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. You can get full control over your team's training schedule, create custom groups and training assignments, and see individual and group analytics. And there's no need to send the staff off-site for training. They can stay right where they are. So go on over to itpro.tv/networkbreak. Use the code NETWORKBREAK30 to try it free for 7 days and receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. To learn more about IT Pro TV's team solution, sign up for a free demo of their supervisor portal. And remember, that's itpro.tv/networkbreak, and the code is NETWORKBREAK30. Thanks, IT Pro TV. Back to the news. Google's, they've been hit with a gender discrimination lawsuit by 3 former employees, and the lawsuit's claims include that there is less pay for women than men for similar work. Women are shunted into lower paying positions and tracks, and women are considered for promotion less frequently than men.
Yeah, well, I don't know what to say with this. As we've said before, anything to do with women in tech is very difficult as an overprivileged middle-class white male for anything. But it does look like, you know, data are there to say that Google isn't actually being fair or reasonable.
Well, certainly the Register article that I read about this notes that Google does have they're very good at acquiring and keeping data. So if that data gets cracked open and we can actually see, then we'll have some very clear evidence.
I hope so. Certainly would like to see equality for women in tech. It'd be good to have more diverse voices so that I don't look like such a crazy nut job most of the time.
Yes, I am all for diversity. And if this is what needs to happen to make it happen, then so be it.
So be it.
All right, sticking with Google, Google Chrome has announced it's removing trust in digital certificates issued by Symantec's public key infrastructure business. In a recent blog, the Chrome team announced a timeline for site operators to replace certificates.
So Symantec was running a root certificate authority for a number of years. If I remember rightly, that was making them an absolute truck ton of money. Basically, the technology angle of that business was incredibly badly run. There was a string of vulnerabilities over, the last 2 or 3 years? I think we reported on several of them here.
Right.
But, Google just said to them, these certificates aren't any good, gave them a couple of warnings over the past year. They haven't fixed anything. And in the end, they sold the business off to somebody else. If that's not an admission that we fundamentally can't run a security business, I don't know what is.
It doesn't look good. They did turn over their business to something called DigiCert Infrastructure. And just to give you a little highlight of what this timeline is, as of Chrome 66 was coming out in March 2018, Chrome is going to stop trusting Symantec certificates issued prior to June 1st, 2016 entirely. And as of the Chrome 70 release, which is scheduled for late fall 2018, Chrome is going to remove trust in any Symantec certificate whatsoever. So time to get your ducks in order.
Now, a lot of you people out there like buying from brands that you know and trust. So let this be a warning to you that a brand is quite often not very good at something, right? As Symantec and Equifax have proved quite consistently. A lot of enterprises bought from Symantec because, you know, antivirus and stuff, all the server software, the backup and stuff. And if you've still got Symantec certificates in your web servers or in any of your internet-facing stuff, or also internally, there's a number of self-signed certificates that they issued over time. They are just going to die. Chrome will just not do them. And I believe also other browser vendors will follow suit in this eventually. So you really need to put this on the list of things that I have to do before the end of the year.
That's right. And apparently Symantec is transitioning its certificate business to DigiCert as of December 1st, 2017. So if you're looking for something to get on your schedule, mark that date down.
I've got to tell you, I nearly set up when I was working in Australia 10 years ago, I actually nearly set up a certificate business because it was so trivial to do.
Oh, truly?
The hardest. It really was, yeah. Back in those days, the only thing that you had to do was you had to talk to Microsoft and Firefox and generate some certificates according to their process, and then pay, I think it was like $50,000 or $100,000 to get your root certificates into the browser. That was it.
Wow.
And then just put up a website and then start making money. And, you know, that's literally what a number of these companies appear to have done. The security on it was so bad.
I mean, just, Come on down like, to Fred's trusty certs.
That's right. It really was that simple. And so the browser makers now are actually looking much more carefully at companies who make certificates. And if they're not good, they are kicking them out. So I would expect more of these. But hopefully this has been a wake-up call to companies. Like for Google to take down one of the biggest names in IT, Symantec, is a real warning message. This is in addition to other companies in China and stuff that have been taken out as well, remember? So this is a big deal. And maybe we'll see the certificate issuing business actually act like a profession instead of like, oh, free money. Woo-hoo-hoo.
Well, that, I mean, when you're talking about the root of trust, that's, you know, the foundation on which all of the internet security is built on, you have to take it seriously. This is not something you fool around with.
Well, clearly we have been.
Why should I be surprised by this?
Yeah, I know. Clearly you're wrong because that's not what's been happening.
Foolish, foolish fellow.
All right, such an idealist.
I really am.
Really?
Too much trust in people.
Yeah.
All right. Toshiba's saga to sell off its flash memory chip business continues. The New York Times is reporting that the Japanese conglomerate is negotiating with Bain Capital, that's a U.S. investment company, to purchase the chip business, which may be worth more than $20 billion.
Yeah, so lots of money. What's interesting about this is that Apple is joining this portfolio. So there was an article somewhere talking about Apple joining in for about $3 billion worth.
Okay, yeah, it's on Bloomberg, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the secret here is that Apple, of course, wants to vertically integrate its silicon. And we talk a lot about merchant silicon here and it's impacting on the networking industry and merchant silicon in IT infrastructure more generally. Like, for example, merchant silicon is affecting storage, you know, distributed storage arrays, even most vertically integrated storage arrays from the traditional vendors are actually just x86 servers in proprietary metal boxes. And that's all merchant silicon, right? We're already seeing merchant silicon run right across the board here. And so to see a major vendor suddenly try to buy a silicon maker and designer is a bit of a thing. Now, Toshiba, of course, is one of the key manufacturers of DRAM. You may or may not know that. And DRAM prices are well up at the moment. You saw the iPhone and the iPad rise at $50 to $100 in the latest rounds because DRAM pricing is up so high. And we've talked in previous shows about HPE is rising prices on its servers because DRAM's increasing. Cisco UCS servers are up because DRAM prices and so forth and so on. So I think Apple wants to sort of get into the chain. Now, could this signal an era where our traditional IT vendors go back to vertically integrating? Is this a sign that owning the farm to plate of IT infrastructure, is this a signal? I don't know. I don't think so. My sense is you could read it as, you know, Apple needs to get a hold of its supply chain and it wants to vertically integrate. But I believe that Cisco, HPE, you know, IBM and Dell, they're getting further and further away from making stuff and they just want to package it up and brand it and then and sell it to you, I think.
Absolutely. If there was one company that, you know, could potentially make an argument for, you know, having that integrated pipeline, it would be Apple because they really, you know, put a premium on their technology from design right into the guts of the device itself. And so building custom silicon for them, I could see them making an argument for why they need to do that as opposed to using off-the-shelf components like everybody else. But yeah, I don't think we're going back to a major trend to see custom silicon everywhere.
We see the Apple A11 chip that they announced this week, and there's an article somewhere out there about it's that chip itself is already faster in its own right than the MacBooks. So you can take an iPhone X, there's someone's caught the fact that someone's been benchmarking it on a public site, and it's better performance than a MacBook running today.
Wow.
So, you know, big x86 server in a MacBook Pro computer, and your iPhone X is already faster than that.
That is amazing.
In terms of some basic benchmarks. So I'm not sure that I can, you know, I sort of want to come at this from the point of view of somebody who says, you know, Apple does just assemble it from off-the-shelf components, and it certainly does. But increasingly, Apple's designing its own CPUs, its own GPUs. It's got its own AI chipset that it's building, and it's giving it a serious competitive edge against its, you know, next nearest rival, Samsung. I would think that companies like Cisco and HP would be looking at this going, how could we do that? How could we have an edge? You know, and they would at least be thinking it. They wouldn't be doing it.
You're absolutely right. They would be thinking it because dollar signs. Yeah, for sure.
Differentiation, what makes me stand out, you know, all those sorts of things. And it really, you know, but on the other hand, I can't convince myself that they actually want to build digital design, you know, silicon design companies like they did 20 years ago, which they did so badly that, you know, obviously they did it badly because Intel came along and took away their business and Toshiba and, you know, that sort of stuff. And they don't want to find, you know, I don't think Cisco could find $10 billion to build a silicon fab. You know, so, you know, to build one and to spend 15 years building it out and investing in it for year after year, I just don't think these companies are able to do that anymore.
They've all, you know, I'm thinking about HPE, how they've made a conscious effort to reduce themselves in size, to be more nimble, more lean. Building your own silicon infrastructure doesn't seem to be aligning with that strategy.
No, no. But it's interesting to play around with the idea of, you know, if you could really build out your own ASIC and you could really differentiate it in your switch, you could then, you know, make yourself better and faster than Broadcom or, you know, XPliant or whatever.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, you're talking not just $50 million, not $100 million, you're talking billions of dollars sustained year on year, every year.
I'm not sure,
you know, how do you calculate the ROI? Where's the profit margin that you can get from selling your switch for, for 30% more than your competitors? I don't think that it's there. Not when the value is in the software.
Right.
The value is not in the hardware. The value is in the software.
For now, yes, at least.
Yes.
All right. This is our last story for the show. Maybe this is our surfing dog one. It's about cord cutting. Apparently, as many as 22 million adults in the U.S. are going to cancel cable or satellite TV service in 2017. And that is up 33% over 2016. And this is according to research firm eMarketer.
Yeah. I think the interesting part here is that this is really, these cable companies in the US in particular are really focused on network as a service. So that is, the network is a vehicle for us to deliver television and subscription video and voice. And people walking away from that is actually basically saying that networking as a service is not what I want. What people want is just connectivity and to some extent some bandwidth. And many of these reports point out that a lot of people are just switching to watching television on the iPhone, on a smartphone, so YouTube or whatever, or subscribing to Netflix. But these cable companies are out there saying, oh, but people want the highest quality. They want 4K. They want, you know, live sports, and they want – and actually that doesn't seem to be true. The numbers are sort of saying out that people don't want a quality of experience. They don't want a high res. At least I'm sure some people do. But more people don't, right?
Yep.
Because if the experience really mattered, then people wouldn't cut the cord. They would be willing to pay even more. Like, I can't believe the price of cable TV in the US generally, but, you know, people would be willing to pay even more to get the biggest, highest res, 4K, you know, whatever it is of it. So I suspect that this is really changing the way carriers look at their networks because it's no longer about multi-service networks with voice and video and, you know, streaming video and television. It's going to be very much about bandwidth, just bandwidth, which is, of course, one of my most favorite topics.
Right, and it's exactly the market direction they don't want to go because just bandwidth, you know, they don't get to add more money for value-added services. And so that's why I think they're really pushing hard against trying to get net neutrality killed, because then if people aren't buying their cable services, then they can try to double dip against, you know, the over-the-top providers like Netflix and others who are, you know, giving folks what they really want, which is, you know, one simple price for all the content I can eat.
It's a complicated, you know, topic. And increasingly, the people who watch cable and pay for cable are actually not the young people.
So, no, there is a really interesting statistic that the growth in cable subscribers is people 55 and older. And if you're an advertiser, you're like, what?
That's not the people I want.
Who I wanted.
Yeah, that's not a growth market. You know,
literally not a growth market.
So there is a whole bunch of really like things here where the people who are buying your product are not the people you want. They reduce the value of the advertising revenue you can make, and you know, it's just. So I think it really is about time these carriers, you know, the people who make these cable or cable networks or proprietary closed networks have to start rethinking their business models. But that's going to take years. That's not something that's going to change overnight. it's just signaling in early that there's something happening here and we need to start, that this could impact us. Because if these companies, these cable networks start to realize, so for example, Comcast, for example, is now very big in its business. And, you know, in the SD-WAN section in the middle of the show, they're very much promoting their SD-WAN business strategy. And you could see them shift away from retail to corporate as they try and move their bandwidth into the enterprise market. Mm-hmm. And that could be very disruptive.
Interesting.
So AT&T and Verizon might be more than a little upset to see to see Comcast offer a serious business market because
they would,
you know, they're losing out in the retail market.
Yeah. Yeah, here's one more statistic before we close this up. The number of consumers who have never had pay TV, never had cable or satellite, is also going to increase by almost 6% to 34.4 million people. So this pressure is coming from both ends, people who are cutting and people who never actually had it in the first place. That's you mentioned signal. And talking about people who, companies that see disruption coming don't know how to get out of the way, here's the signal, folks. This is the tsunami coming. You cable companies, you got to figure out what you're doing.
Yeah, I'll put a link in here as well. There's a really good one. It's a Wall Street Journal, which means it's behind a paywall. But the article talks about, and it's dead serious, by the way, millennials are discovering major TV channels on free-to-air.
That's right. Hey, kids, there is still free TV.
They've just never seen television over an antenna. And it's kind of amusing. And apparently there's a big thing going around saying whatever. But I do feel that originally I thought it was a joke, but apparently no, it's actually Carl Villabolos, 21, who was selling tube-shaped digital antennas at a swap meet in San Diego, said customers often ask if his 20 to 25 products are legal. They don't trust me when I say that these are actually free local channels.
It's totally true. My own kids have never experienced free over-the-air television. It's just not part of their existence.
Here it goes. Here's a crack at it. Earlier this year, he got an earful from a woman who didn't get it. She was mad, she recalls. She said, no, you can't live in America for free. What are you talking about? Wow. Almost a third of Americans, 29%, are unaware local TV is available free. I mean, there's a triumph of marketing by the cable companies.
Yeah, right? I guess so.
So interesting times.
Oh,
so.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I thought it was hysterical. There you go. There's our shaggy dog story for the week.
Indeed it is. All right, that brings us to the end of the show. Where can folks get your social details, Greg?
You can find me on the Twitter as @EthereumMind. I've actually been doing some trial posting on Facebook. So I have a Facebook page. Please don't friend me personally. I don't use the personal parts of Facebook. Only personal friends are there. But I don't actually use that either. But find my Greg Farrow Ethereal Mind page on the Facebooks. I'm on the Twitter as @EthereumMind. And I'm still posting occasionally on EthereumMind.com as well as on the Packet Pushers website.
And I'm Drew Conroy Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM and I blog at PacketPushers.net. Thanks to our sponsor, IT Pro TV. And thank you, as always, for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, hit us up on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share this with your friends. And check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can get them for free if you sign up as a member at PacketPushers.net/members. Thanks for listening.